evening and welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Brian. This is Brian in Buffalo, New York, US of A, and with me as always,
Lauren from Swansea. How are you, Brian?
I am groovy. I am, it's been a fun-filled day because, just a couple days ago, like 2 days ago, was the Kentucky Derby.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest horse race in the world, you know?
Did you become a millionaire from your bet?
I did not become a millionaire, but I did bet the 80-1 long shot and won. Second biggest upset in the history of the Kentucky Derby, 80-1, and I picked that horse and I won.
What did you win?
I won quite a bit. We're not going to say exact amounts, but it was quite a bit.
£2.50 and a bag of Haribos.
It did not enough to put me in a new tax bracket, but it made grocery shopping much easier this month and next. How about that?
That's good.
Yeah, so I'm in good mood.
So you won a 2 month supply of Duff's.
I went and celebrated at Duff's, thank you very much. I actually did. I called my brother, I said, "We're going to Duff's, baby. Pack the bags." Oh,
that's what you want. You won two months supply of Duff's.
I love the Kentucky Derby. I bet the Kentucky Derby every year. And I've had some wins, you know, mostly losses like you do when you bet on horses. But I've never had this big a win because an 80-1 horse has never won. So
I mean, even if you put on a really, really tiny bet, that's still quite a lot of money in return.
Exactly. I bet more than the minimum, Lauren, I'll tell you that. Well, the minimum is $2.
And you bet for... He bet Cleocatra's
no
biscuit fund for a month.
Oh, Cleo's getting specialty food, okay? Let's put it that way. No, I didn't win that much, but it was a nice little win.
No, what I'm saying is your stake was what you would spend on Cleocatra's biscuits for a month.
No. Maybe what I'd spend on Cleo's treats for a week.
Well, that's not too bad.
No, it was... I never go overboard with betting on horse racing. It's more for fun, and it's always the kind of thing like, if I lose, so what? It was just a little tiny bit of money. But winning 80-1 is good.
I mean, the thing is, it's the Kentucky Derby.
Yes, and now in 2 weeks, I get to bet again. Oh, I love horse racing. You know, it's funny. I just hit me. The Canadian Triple Crown, one of the races, the American, the Triple Crown is the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont. In Canada, one of the legs of the Canadian Triple Crown is the Prince of Wales Run.
Yeah.
Which is done at Fort Erie Racetrack, which is just over the border, a 15-minute drive from where I live. And I used to go there to bet the Prince of Wales every year for their big race. Even when it was Charles, the Prince of Wales. He never showed up for it, by the way.
Charles is still the Prince of Wales.
Oh, that's right. He still is, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, well, he never showed up.
He's got more responsibilities now because the Queen has got mobility issues and she's going to miss the state opening of Parliament because she's walking with a stick now.
You know, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful to your royal family.
Yes.
But I probably will come across that way anyway. But I must say, now that Charles is elderly, because how old is Charles now?
He's in his 70s.
Yeah. Now that Charles is elderly, he's not nearly as bizarre looking as he used to be. He grew into his face. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Remember when he was young? Well, you don't. You weren't born yet, or you were too young to realize it, but those ears that jutted out the side, and he just looked so silly. Now that he's elderly, he kind of looks distinguished.
Mm. And in 30 or so years, your president could be of British descent when Meghan and Harry's children decide to run for president.
Nah, it'll never happen.
Yeah, well,
Nah, ain't no
they'll
fucking blue
run.
bloods running in our country.
They will run.
I thought, that's an interesting thing. Can you imagine if that happened?
And George the Third would be so happy.
Oh, just how
Yeah,
fucking insane that would be. Okay, I don't like the thought of that. I'm gonna stop now because that's really creepy to think about.
the British have sneaked back control of your country.
Yeah, that's. This was your
Like,
plan all along, wasn't it?
yes, it was George the Third's master plan.
Well, he was
His
crazy.
revenge on George Washington.
Yeah, George was crazy, so maybe it's true.
Yeah,
Oh, that makes me go.
we've decided you're not responsible enough to play with your country anymore. We're taking it off
So you're sending him in the form of the royal baby, sort of like Damien in The Omen. You're setting it up for him to be the Antichrist to run the world from afar.
Well, America.
Just America. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
That would be funny though, because
No.
it would be
Really wouldn't be funny.
funny. It really would be
You want funny? I'll give you funny. I got jokes.
That was a joke. I just told a joke.
Yeah, but I got real jokes on. You ready for a joke?
Oh, go on then.
Why is Peter Pan always flying?
I don't know.
'Cause he never lands.
That is funny.
You laughed at one of my jokes. I haven't been laughed at so hard since I was fired from that orange juice factory.
What happened there?
They said I couldn't concentrate. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, Lauren has a case of the giggles today. I could tell any joke.
Did I not tell you about Theo asked me when I was going to have babies and give him cousins?
No.
He came up with their names. Apparently, there will be four of them.
Oh, you're gonna have four babies.
Yeah, and they're going to be called Fuck, Shit, Fuck Off, and Dickhead.
So, according to Theo, your children's names will be, please repeat that list.
Oh God, it was fuck, shit, fuck off, and dickhead. So something
Does it
like
matter what their genders are?
that. No, their names.
Like, dickhead could be boy or girl?
Yeah.
Or trans. We're not judging. Did you ask him why?
Because they're just nice names.
They're very nice names. I agree. Those are nice names. I think those were four of the seven dwarves, were they not? Sneezy, dickhead, doc, fuck. Dopey. Dickhead.
You should tell him off for swearing, but you can't because he just comes
Oh,
up and
you can't.
flares.
That's just beautiful. Oh, listen to us potty mouths. And we have got like such a cool, like classy show tonight.
I know, but yeah.
And we're out here
According to
telling.
Theo, those are my children.
Oh, yeah, because tonight. We actually got Dr. Colleen Darnell, the world-famous vintage Egyptologist, the classiest woman in science and history and Egyptology, and she's coming onto the show where fuck, shit, dickhead is her lead-in. Way to go, Lauren.
I'm sorry.
Would you like me to tell one more joke, maybe to get us back on a clean slate?
Okay.
Ooh, I'll do one that will tie into tonight's episode. Who was King Tut's favorite chef?
I don't know, Ryan.
Gordon Ramsay's.
I like Gordon Ramsay.
I just love that I got three
No,
laughs
but
from you out of
honestly,
my jokes today.
I know. But no, Colin Darnell is a fantastic scientist. I mean, Egyptology is a science because of all the archaeology that's required to go with it, and all the, you know, the study of the landscapes, and, you know, making sure that you're not going to get buried in the sand and become a mummy yourself.
And what's really cool is we did this interview with her, and I'm not breaking the fourth wall here. Well, fuck it, I am. But we did this interview with her a few days ago, because as we speak right now, which is before we're going to release the episode in two more days, she's on a plane back to Cairo for another excavation.
I know. It just always makes me so happy to see her and her husband on a documentary, because they always look so neat and well turned out, and it's just beautiful.
And she's an absolute sweetheart.
People. Yes, very lovely lady.
Phenomenal. And she'll be, you know, a little later we'll come up with the interview with her. Now, I do want to warn the audience. Not warn. That sounds like, all right, trigger warning. No. I just want to let the audience know that our interview with Dr. Darnell is a little shorter than most of our typical show interviews. You know, our show tends to run the interview an hour to an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours. With Dr. Darnell, we only had about 40 minutes to talk.
Yes.
Because she was preparing for this trip. But she did say she will come back. And she's got some exciting news when she gets back in the States. And yes, She'll be back on the show to share that.
I mean, it was so generous of her to give that time to us. You know, because international travel like that is such an expedition in its own right that, you know, it was very kind of her to give up that time.
Yeah, especially this close to her leaving. Now, people, don't just think she's flying out and it's the time and everything, but, you know, they got to shut down their house. They've got to board their animals. They've got to, they both work university jobs. They have to take care of all that. They have to get everything done. And just for her to set aside that time, and she had a good time. She's so sweet. She's so wonderful. And she had to deal with me. How do you compete?
You know, she was very lovely, very, very, it was just, she's a very charming and sweet person. And it was just such a joy to have those 40 minutes with her. And I mean, you know, that is a lot of time, especially when, like you said, you know, you've got so much to do.
Yeah. Now, we'll get to that interview in a bit, but I want to talk about some other stuff going on right now.
Oh, goodness.
All right. I'm getting a little sick of the nerd rage out there of people bashing the Book of Boba Fett series. Because it was awesome, and I loved it. And I know Obi-Wan's starting in a little while, and everyone's geeking out over that, but you know it's just a matter of time before the nerd rage starts on that, too.
I promise, listeners, we are not sponsored by Disney Plus.
We aren't. I am just a big fan, and I loved the Book of Boba Fett. And did you watch it yet?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I gave you a homework assignment, and you didn't do it. But
well, come on, Brian. I'm still getting used to having evenings. I used to work in a cinema where I would be working at this time of night. Yeah. I'm still getting used to having evenings and having a job that finishes at 5 p.m. and that's it.
Well, that's all I want to say on that is that Book of Boba Fett was awesome. I don't care what y'all say. It was great. And Obi-Wan's going to be great, and that starts up soon. Now, have you gotten the nephews into the whole Star Wars thing yet?
Corey's more Doctor Who, though I don't know how... He is a bit cross that the Doctor is a woman this time. He is very happy that the Doctor is a boy again.
Well, that's a typical boy reaction.
Yes, it is. Yes, he likes Cybermen, and he's not too keen on... I don't know. I think Star Wars hasn't been on his radar. Theo, if it's not football or wrestling, he doesn't want to know.
Really? Well, I think you should get them into Star Wars.
Sorry, soccer and wrestling.
I'll let you say football. You got enough of an accent where people aren't going to mistake it.
But I need to make the distinction just in case somebody thinks that I let Theo, who is mental, play American football.
You know,
he would be very good.
I know he's a big, well, he's a little small, but I know he's a big soccer fan, football. And I know your father was a big football fan.
Yes.
What about rugby? Is that big there?
He does play rugby, and he's very good at rugby because once he's got the ball, nobody can get it off him because he holds on so tight. So he is very good.
So like,
he's a very good sportsman.
What would you say the three or four biggest sports would be in Wales?
Rugby, football, cricket.
Anything else?
Tennis, like, maybe.
I was going to say, like, hurling, but is that more Ireland only?
No, I would say, children play, there's field hockey as well, mm-hmm. but, no, I would say football, cricket, and rugby, yeah. Cricket's even worse than baseball.
Well, that's so funny, because none of those are considered our major sports, although football / soccer is becoming a major sport in America.
You've had some of our players before they retire.
Well, I predict that within another generation, it might be the second or third biggest sport in America. So many kids play it. It's a much bigger participated in sport than any of the other sports with the youth of this country. And it's growing. I mean, it's growing by leaps and bounds. The thing is, we were never that good at it internationally.
Well, the thing is it's very easy to play as well, whereas cricket, you need equipment. With American football, you need equipment. Otherwise, you're going to end up in A&E.
Yeah.
So with football, you just need a ball and a couple of jumpers for goalposts.
And that's, you know, in America with the youth, basketball is such a big game for kids to play because, like you said, all you need is one ball and every playground has basketball hoops up.
Oh, I forgot about that. Not all our playgrounds have basketball hoops. So football would be.
You see, in America, it would probably be, as far as participation with the youth go, I would say probably number one and two would be like baseball and organized. I would say it's baseball and soccer. Non-organized, just like kids out playing in the park, it would be basketball. Would probably be number one, followed by baseball. But
well, yeah, because baseball again, you don't need a lot of equipment.
No, and baseball is so ingrained in American society.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird because our other main sports, football, is our, you know, probably, I think it's our most attended sport in the country. Professional basketball, professional football, baseball are still the three big ones, followed by NASCAR and hockey, and probably soccer is really climbing up on that ladder fast. I would really, you know, I'd like to do an episode about maybe the history of the World Cup or the history of soccer. I know it's such a long history, but it's the fact that it's so big internationally and it's becoming so big in America, I think that'd make an interesting show.
Yeah, sorry, that's a bit sad for me because my dad would have loved that, but he's not here to listen to it.
We could do it as a tribute to him.
Thank you. And if you can get somebody from Liverpool Football Club, that would be even better.
Well, I mean, I'd like to know about the history because, I mean, I've read that, you know, soccer started out as like a war game of people kicking the heads of the decapitated prisoners around and stuff. And who knows if that's true?
I know.
You know, I'd like to know the true history. We've done shows on the true history of baseball and things. So it'd be interesting. It'd be a fun show, I think. Maybe. Yeah. You know, write that down, Lauren. You're the smart one. Write down, okay. We'll search for a soccer historian, and we'll do a nice football / soccer episode.
Yep, that's all written down.
I still don't like it, but that's because I'm of a generation of America where, look, America, I know the whole USA, USA, but the rule of thumb was if we weren't good at it, we hated it. And if we qualified for the World Cup for many years, we got our asses whipped. It wasn't until we beat Mexico in the World Cup in the, it was what, the, probably the 96 World Cup.
Yeah, that's right.
When we beat Mexico, I think that's when soccer took a turn in America. Started becoming bigger.
When you hosted the World Cup, though, you did a very good job of it.
Mm. Yeah, we did. But we were lucky because we have a country that's so big and so spread out, and we have so many stadiums that were built for football that can be converted to soccer fields or football fields, if you prefer, that we were already tailor-made for it. Yeah, we did a really good job of it. I'm not trying to pat ourselves on the back because I didn't go to any of it. We did a good job hosting it. And
you did.
That was a big one. That was a turning point. That was, I think, 92?
Yeah, because that was very fun to watch.
Yeah, I think that was the 92 games. And then in 96, we beat Mexico in the first round. And people started taking notes. And then, of course, our women's team dominates, which is huge. That's really put a lot of young girls into soccer in this country. Having our U.S. women's team be so dominant the past several years. It's a plus. And it's nice to see female athletes getting recognition. Because that's something America's never been that known for. Unlike other countries that, you know, have. Not so much here. So what about you, Lauren? Anything stuck in your craw today?
No, not really.
Nothing?
No.
Why not?
I don't know.
Hmm.
I don't know.
You want to move on to our Today in History?
I think we should.
All right. Well, I got a good one today.
I've got a good one, too.
Well, mine is from Today in History, May 9th, 1887. Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West Show opens in London for the first time. Now, I like that one, Lauren, for two reasons. One, it's ultra-Americana, Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West Show. Two, it's the UK, you know, your land. But three, if you remember all the way back to episode 57 of our show, when we had Bob Bowes Bell, the great Old West historian, on, and we talked about the Victorian Old West and how in London, they were going all nuts for Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West Show, and in the Old West towns, they were watching Shakespeare.
I know, right?
Unlike, folks, go back and listen to that episode. It's so fascinating. That was good.
Because cowboys drunk gin.
Yeah, and it wasn't like, you know, the movies where, give me the rot gut sarsaparilla. No, these guys, what was the...
really?
It was, wasn't it a gin fizzy or something like that?
Yeah, gin fizzy.
They were drinking... And the primary theater was Shakespeare, not can-can girls and all that, you know, shit-kicking cowboy stuff. It was, they're going for an evening of Shakespeare and gin fizzies. It just shows you, you know, history...
is weird.
Hollywood doesn't always give you an accurate portrayal of history. But yeah, it was actually today in history, back in the Victorian era, 1887, that the Wild West shows of America went to London. All right, your turn.
So in tribute to grand voyages, I went for the closest one I could find about voyages. So mine is the 9th of May, 1502. Christopher Columbus set sail from Cadiz in Spain on his fourth and final voyage, hoping to find passage to Asia.
Yeah, how'd that work out for you, Chris?
I know Christopher Columbus is very problematic.
Yeah.
But we'll let that go.
I got in an argument with someone a couple of years ago, maybe, about Columbus. And they're like, oh, you're doing the revisionist history. And we look back now and say he was a bad person. But at the time, I'm like, no. At the time, everyone was pretty much saying he was an asshole.
Yeah, basically, the voyages were funded by people who wanted to get him out of the country.
Yeah, people, look it up. At the time of his life, everyone hated him and said he was a piece of shit.
Yeah.
It's not revisionist. He was always an asshole.
He used to make such grand promises.
What a piece of work.
Yeah.
And yet America named a holiday after him. But that's being fixed. And that's, you know, I'm not one of those people who says we should rewrite all of history, but I think we're not rewriting history. We're telling the truth in history now. Columbus was a dick. Not dickhead. He was not one of your children.
No, he was not.
You know, I always hated that he discovered America. Really? I think there were people here before that.
There was it was a Welsh person that discovered America.
Well, if you want to be technical, maybe. That's all.
Dinosaurs discovered. Just dinosaurs discovered America.
Well, no, I'll give you a technical maybe on your Welshy discovering America.
It's better than Christopher Columbus.
Yes. Much more reasonable an assumption than Columbus, but it's still a hard maybe. You know why that is?
No.
Because we're not sure he was actually first. What? Tell the audience who we're talking about first off.
Oh, the Vikings.
Yes.
But then I would say that the dinosaurs founded it before the Vikings because there were dinosaurs in America.
You know, there were. And when I was a little kid, I used to think I could find their bones in my backyard. Never did.
So I would say that the dinosaurs discovered America.
Well, the dinosaurs didn't discover it. They just kind of ended up here.
They did.
Oh, your foot down, you're saying dinosaurs?
I mean, yeah.
All right, which dinosaurs?
Triceratops.
Nah, I think it'd be a brontosaurus.
I don't know.
I watch a lot of Flintstones, Lauren. I'm pretty sure it was a brono.
We'll have to ask. Get us a dinosaur. Get us a paleontologist right now.
Why can't you hear a pterodactyl go to the bathroom?
I don't know.
Because the pee is silent. All right. On that note, enough of this. Let's get serious and bring on a distinguished doctor, an Egyptologist, just this incredible person, and I'll fire up the magic interview box.
It's the magic interview box.
And Lauren, you get to flip the switch.
Okay.
Lauren, are you ready for this?
I think I am.
I don't know if you are, because I don't know if I am, because you know me. I've wanted to do a show on Egyptology forever. When Sarah suggested I reach out to our guest tonight, I said, there is absolutely no way in hell that she will say yes to coming on to this show, especially when she's probably heard about the things I've asked Allison Weir and stuff.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, so I send an email figuring it's going to be get lost, and it was a yes. So after I, you know, woke up from passing out, I just went nuts, and I dug out her books again because I'm a huge fan of Echoes of Egypt, which is just incredible.
You're a big fan of Egyptology because you got very jealous because I got to work with a mummy when I did my guided tour.
You did, yeah. But then I also dug out the Ancient Egyptian Netherworlds books, and I managed to land. All right, you ready for this, people? The Theta Barrett of Burial Chambers, the Garbo of Giza, Dr. Carlene Darnell. The vintage Egyptologist is actually here. Welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings.
Thank you so much, Brian. And it's lovely to be with you as well, Lauren, from across the Atlantic.
Now, would you prefer the Theta Bera of Burial Chambers, or the Garbo of Giza, or how about Mary Pickford with a pickaxe?
I would have a hard time choosing between those because they're all great actresses.
I was thinking Louise Brooks too, because there is a striking resemblance between yourself and Louise Brooks, who I make it a habit of visiting her grave yearly to take flowers to, by the way.
That's wonderful.
I am so thrilled you are here because, as Lauren said, I'm an Egyptology nerd. There is no one in the world cooler when it comes to the world of Egyptology than yourself. Mainly because Boris Karloff is dead now. So you now are the coolest.
Well, thank you.
I need to know how you got so into the whole concept, because your specialty in Egyptology is not the typical, oh, look, there's a mummy. I mean, you get into the really intricate stuff like the militaries and the armies of the pharaohs and the fiction of the time. I mean, you dig deeper than most people do. Where did this fascination come from?
Well, first of all, thank you about the comments about my specialties. And indeed, I have been very fortunate to be able to work on such a diversity of topics, because Egyptology as a field, being able to read hieroglyphic inscriptions, only goes back to 100 years, to 1822. And so there's so much left to be done. And it's not just a question of what's in the field in Egypt, which is also amazing. I mean, the discoveries that are being announced by the Ministry of Antiquities on a nearly weekly basis are really incredible. But also the material that's left to be found in museums. And that's a lot of what I have worked on, are papyri in museums that have been published, but perhaps not fully understood in terms of being works of ancient Egyptian historical fiction, or the late Egyptian netherworld books. They're giant stone sarcophagi in the Louvre, in the British Museum, in Cairo, in the Egyptian Museum, and no one had done an edition of them. So for me, I have always loved Egypt, like yourself, this idea, and Lauren, the idea that Egypt is eternally fascinating. And so I think a lot of people who end up in the field of Egyptology did love it as kids. And I certainly fall into that category, as does my husband, Professor John Darnell at Yale University. But I think what makes the field most exciting to me, and why I am still doing it, is that it is constantly a new interest. So even though I've been doing it for years and years, I always feel like there's something new. I always feel like there's something left to be discovered. Even if it's not something you uncover in the sands of the Egyptian desert, it can just be looking at a photograph or an inscription in a totally new way. You can make new discoveries in your library. And that, to me, is what's so exciting about Egyptology.
Hey, Lauren, did you catch how she dropped her husband in there? Because she knows my reputation to flirty flirt. That was a little preemptive stop the flirty flirt, I think.
Yes, that was. And I'm so glad that action was taken.
I actually had no idea. I was just, because we write together and because he's also been interested in Egypt since he was a kid, that was purely the motivation.
Also, the flirty flirt's okay. That comes back now. What was it that first, like, got you so fascinated? Because, like, for me, it was two things that are completely, people don't believe me, but it's true. It was, you know, the Boris Karloff film, The Mummy, and it was Steve Martin's King Tut song that got me really interested as a kid. I was a kid of the 70s, you know? What about you?
For me, it was really books. So I grew up in St. Louis, and there is a small Egyptian collection at the St. Louis Art Museum, but that's not what really did it in terms of sparking my interest. It was purely reading and seeing pictures and wanting to be able to read hieroglyphs. But I do appreciate that popular culture is a great conduit for sparking interest. More recently, like last night, so let's see, this is May 5th, there was the season finale to Moon Knight. And I wouldn't have otherwise watched it, but so many people have asked me about its Egyptian connections, and it got me interested in the show, and I know it's gotten a lot of people interested in ancient Egypt. So I'm very much in favor of engaging with the widest possible audience, because so many people become interested in topics for different reasons, and what ultimately matters is that you learn real information, not your starting point of the interest.
No, and like I said, it was, you know, Karloff and Steve Martin, but it turned into a lifelong obsession. I was a little heartbroken when I realized the Karloff movie was not a documentary. That broke my heart a bit, but I got over it. You have done some documentaries that are just absolutely incredible. I mean, you're so, your style and your image, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with you because I, you know, talked you up and talk about you, and you're pretty famous. But if people don't, just Google her right now, Google her image, and you'll understand the Garbo of Giza. You are so photogenic, and yet it's still the substance over style that makes your documentary appearances so fascinating. That's really admirable.
Well, thank you very much. And I always feel like the images, for example, on Instagram or wearing something that might be a little bit more interesting on camera than just kind of usual ensembles is a great way to visually draw interest. And then once you have people paying attention, you can really provide quite a lot of information. So I feel like there's so much visually of interest in ancient Egypt. It's also very easy to then hold people's attention because everyone wants to know what the hieroglyphs say or what the images mean. And that's a really exciting part. But thank you for your kind words.
You should be doing more of them because they do Shark Week. They should just do Dr. Darnell Week of just all Egyptology because they are just incredible. Now, you've been, obviously, several times. Have you ever eaten at the KFC that's directly across the street?
Oh, from the Giza Pyramids. Yes, I actually have. And there's also a McDonald's that overlooks a Luxor temple in part of the city. And it's great because it's so much a part of the cityscape. And it's a great view of the temple. So, yes, although I much prefer local cuisine to fast food in Egypt.
I just can't imagine sitting in a KFC, you know, getting my coleslaw, because they do have the best coleslaw in the world. They're not even a sponsor, but if they want to sponsor me for free coleslaw, you're more than welcome to.
I think Duff's might have something to say about that, because yes, that is also a second unofficial sponsor.
True. Duff's chicken wings are better than KFC chicken. But I can't imagine sitting in a KFC looking out the window and seeing the Great Pyramids. That's just so surreal to me.
It's an interesting juxtaposition, but I think that's true of so many. I mean, there have to be similar things in other capitals of Europe. I can't imagine that it's not.
Yeah. You could probably see the Eiffel Tower from a McDonald's, I'm sure. But that's a little different than...
Yes, you can. I can actually attest to from the McDonald's in the center of Paris, you can see the Eiffel Tower. I went there on a school trip.
That's just wrong.
Well, thank you, Lauren, for the confirmation of that. And I think the other important thing about this is that when we think about Cairo, like, and then this comes out in the show Moon Knight, too, showing that the pyramids are right next to the city now, and just that it's such a modern metropolis. And I think that's the other really exciting thing about going to Egypt, is that it's not just all the ancient sites, but the modern country is so vibrant, and there's so much to experience.
And I wish I could go, except for the fact that I really, you know, I'm from Buffalo. I don't like the heat. In all your adventures there, what was the most standout visual or just something that you saw, maybe unexpectedly, or maybe something you were expecting to see that just totally floored you and was like, okay, this is so badass, I got to tell everybody.
Oh, I mean, there's actually a number of different stories I could tell with that, but I'll just choose one because it's probably the most ripped from a movie plot. And it was a discovery that I made with the expedition that I directed in 2009 in conjunction with the local inspectorate of the Ministry of Antiquities out of Esna. And I was surveying around an area north of an ancient city called Moala. So actually, Moala is the modern city. The ancient city was probably called Hefat, or the city of the serpent. And it was a provincial capital about 2150 BCE, was sort of its heyday during the first intermediate period. And Moala itself, the necropolis, is well known because it is the location of the tomb of a man named Ankhtifi. And the autobiographical inscription of Ankhtifi in hieroglyphs in his tomb is one of the single most important documents that we have from the entire first intermediate period, roughly between 2150 and 2055 BCE. Other than that tomb, the area had not really been surveyed. And John had given me an article from the early 1900s by a German Egyptologist and really explorer named Georg Schweinfurt. And he had published two sites, one north of Moala and one east of El Kab, which is actually where we will be next week, starting our summer field season. And he published a number of these buildings, or at least describes them and includes a few photos. And they're pretty substantial dry stone structures, so built without mortar. And he didn't have a really good idea as to the date. He thought they maybe were medieval, maybe more modern, wasn't certain. And the only description of the site was in this article, and it had a sketch map that accompanied it. And so it had a drawing of the local site, which was Debabia along the Nile, and then the drawing of a wadi, one of these dry desert canyons, and a literal X marks the spot of the ancient settlement. And no one had been there for over 100 years. And so we go drive down into the desert following this ancient sketch map. And sure enough, there were hundreds of structures. And from analyzing the pottery, they're actually late Roman, between 400 and 600 CE. And they weren't built by the Romans or even dwellers in the Nile Valley. They were built by Eastern desert tribes. Probably the same as what the Romans at least describe in text as a group called the Blemmyes. And it's hard to know exactly what they called themselves, but it's probably similar because of how it appears in text. And we've subsequently found several additional settlements that were totally unknown east of El Kab. And that's been really exciting because the structures are above ground. You just walk out and you see them. We excavate inside to get a sense of habitation debris and things like that. But otherwise, they just are visually very obvious. You don't have to imagine what they look like. Like, they're right there.
How different was the architecture, the structures themselves?
So the walls range in height from just like a couple stones high to up to 2 meters in height. And the walls still, many of them still survive because comparatively speaking, it's not that old.
No, compared to some of the sites, yeah.
Yeah, for ancient Egypt. And in the Eastern Desert, there isn't a lot of sand. So it's not like they're going to be totally covered by a sand dune. And they range from being fairly rectangular. In fact, some of them are shockingly precise in terms of corners, which is interesting because until you photograph them and create a three-dimensional model, which we do with a colleague of ours at Yale named Alberto Orchia, it's pretty standard practice now, but we used it right when it was getting started, a program called MetaShape, where you take a series of 2D photographs, run them through this software that's not even that complicated to use, at least if you're doing basic functionality, and you can create a 3D rotatable model. And once you have the 3D model, you can see, oh, wow, they really knew what they were doing when they were building these. These aren't just haphazardly constructed. And then others are round, and a lot of times they will, I want to say cheat, but it's not really cheating. They will use the natural surroundings to their benefit. So they will add a wall to a boulder as opposed to constructing walls from scratch.
Now, people are going to think I'm trying to be funny here, but I'm actually not, folks. If these were Roman structures, were there bathrooms?
Oh, these are pretty small. So they're only probably sleeping areas for a couple of people. Some of the rooms, I think the largest structure, maybe 2 meters by 5 meters, and you're in the middle of a desert. And in fact, even in the Nile Valley, it's fairly difficult to create a sewer system in ancient times the way we know of ancient Rome, for example, just because the water table is so high. So it would have been much more hygienic to simply use the open space.
Use the natural litter box. Yeah. Now, the next question I have to ask, and Lauren, you got to answer this too. Should I legally change my name to Octifi? Because I think Transatlantic History Rams with Lauren and Octifi sounds awesome.
No. No? Please don't.
You wrote this just incredible book that dealt with the armies of some of the pharaohs. How advanced was their military in comparison to the rest of the world at the time? Because I don't think a lot of people think about the might of their military so much as, you know, you just picture, you know, King Tut sitting on a throne, or, you know, Cleopatra, you know, eating grapes or whatever. But how advanced and how powerful were the militaries that they had?
So during the late Bronze Age, which is the period of military history that I've worked the most on, the first in 2003, which was an analysis and new translation of the great Karnak inscription of Merneptah, roughly 1208 BCE. It's a year 5 inscription talking about an invasion of Egypt by Libyans and a group of people called the Sea Peoples, people of the sea in ancient Egyptian. And that's a really fascinating, fascinating topic. And then in 2007, I'd have to check the publication date. John and I published Tutankhamun's Armies, Battle and Conquest in Ancient Egypt's Late 18th Dynasty.
One of my favorite books on Egyptology, by the way.
Well, thank you. So I guess before I answer anything about the military, I will have to say that if you like Tutankhamun's Armies or have any interest in King Akhenaten and Queen Nefertiti, I will plug our forthcoming book. It's November 1st, Egypt's Golden Couple, When Akhenaten and Nefertiti Were Gods on Earth. So it does have a chapter on foreign policy, a couple chapters on foreign policy, the Nubian War of Akhenaten, which we also talk about in Tutankhamun's Armies, and some of the Amarna letters. Mostly it's a biography of their reign, so not purely on the military. But I just wanted to mention that since Tutankhamun's Armies came up, and it's very much an updated biography of his parents. So the Egyptian military in the late Bronze Age is one of the most advanced in the world. And all of this revolves around the arms race of the period, which is the chariot. And although the Egyptians did not invent the chariot, it came in from lands to the northeast, at least enters the ancient Near Eastern world, probably through the land of Mitanni. And when it gets to Egypt, it is perfected, I think is something we can say, based on the quality of the wood, the construction of the wheels, and how the Egyptians were able to make such a light and maneuverable machine. And then they poured a lot of resources into training the horses and pasturing and everything that revolved around maintaining a top-notch chariotry. So I do think the ancient Egyptians should be known more for their military prowess, because they were pretty amazing when it came to strategy, as well as not just the fighting capabilities of their military, but also diplomacy and strategy, and really using the advantages of their location, both in terms of natural protection because of deserts and the sea, but also exploiting their position in Northeast Africa and being able to form connections with so many different groups and alliances. And they had this really well-developed process where they would have foreign princes or kings allow their children to be raised at the ancient Egyptian court alongside the future Egyptian king, so that he essentially became friends with the future rulers of other states. And I always thought that was, like, in addition to obviously marrying foreign princesses, which the Egyptians also did, I just think that's kind of a cool way to exert soft power.
It's so mind-blowing to me that you describe these, the armies and these. I think to most people, the image we have in our head of Egypt is just sand and gold and, you know, kings and priests. You don't think of horses. You don't think of pastures. You don't think of all these things that we know had to exist, but they're just not part of what we have in our minds. And you bring that out and you show it to us and you make it so real. It's just fascinating.
Well, thank you. And I think it really is important to get beyond mummies and pyramids and gold. All three of those things, very significant to Egyptians.
Yeah.
But it's understanding the context. I gave a class for kids about mummies, and I didn't show a single mummy. I didn't show a single human body. I don't believe that's a good thing in PowerPoints or images. And we can talk about what it meant to mummify a person and what it meant to their afterlife beliefs without looking at the actual unwrapped bodies, which the ancient Egyptians did not intend people to see. And I think it's just so much going beyond, okay, here's a lot of stones piled atop one another, but what did that mean? Why did they do it? What did it signify? And the fact that it encapsulates, like with the mummies, the significance of solar religion. And that's another thing we don't think about because of this idea of death in ancient Egypt being so overwhelming of a consideration, that people lived in order to have a good death or take things with them to the afterlife. And that's really not the point. The point is that they enjoyed life so much, they wanted it to last forever. And that by joining with the sun god, they achieved an immortality through eternal recurrence. And the mummy was intended to be a receptacle for the soul so that the soul could join the sun and then reunite with the corpse every night. And the pyramid, the whole point is that it's the mound of creation created by the sun at the beginning of time. And the shape of the pyramid relates to the very top of something called the Benben stone, which is the most important solar monument in Egypt. And if you look at the corners of the three pyramids at Giza, they actually point towards ancient Unnu, Heliopolis to the Greeks, and a suburb of modern Cairo, which was the most significant cult center for the sun god. So most aspects of ancient Egypt, and the same is true of gold. Gold relates to solar worship. It is incorruptible. And all of these things relate to these fundamental aspects of Egyptian religion. And I think once you understand that side of things, and Akhenaten is the ultimate in taking Egyptian solar religion to its logical conclusions, where there is only the sun god and him and Nefertiti. I think understanding solar religion really helps us appreciate so many aspects of ancient Egypt that otherwise are often only understood at a superficial level.
Well, another thing that I don't think many people understand about just the term ancient Egypt, especially in America, like us Americans, as Lauren always points out, we really have no history. You know, we're just over 200 years old.
Don't say that. Brian, stop misrepresenting.
She once told me that England is where the history comes from. But
no, I did not say that. I did not say that. I said that America is a young country and that the problems that they have today are problems that we had time to deal with hundreds of years ago.
So all right, I'll
that's
be
what
fair.
I said. I said that. I said America is a young country.
But
I mean, there's lots of problems with some things that the British did as well. I mean, we like to go places and plant flags.
That's true. But when you say ancient Egypt, we're not talking a small window, a time frame. I mean, This was a society that was self-sustained for how long?
So the origins of pharaonic civilization with the invention of writing, which is obviously when history proper begins, is 3250 BCE approximately. And in terms of a living tradition of Egyptian religion, which fundamentally defines ancient Egyptian culture, ends about 400 CE, when 394 is the last hieroglyphic inscription. But also, I mean, there's a tremendous prehistory, and that's, I think, something else that we have to think about everywhere in the world is, in fact, the Americas have a history going back thousands of years. It's just not tied to a written tradition. And the same is true in Egypt, where there's a very long period of prehistory and the development of culture prior to the invention of writing, what we call the pre-dynastic civilizations.
They kept records at a time when a lot of civilizations and cultures didn't. It just, we couldn't understand them at all for a while, but.
Yes, and that's one of the things that most appeals to me about studying ancient Egypt is the ability to read what they wrote. And you can pick up a letter that someone did not intend anybody other than the recipient of the letter to read and get a peek into their day-to-day concerns. And obviously there's certain epistolary formula. They're not writing diaries or intimate correspondence, but you do get a sense of, you know, I'm going away, take care of my house, and don't forget to say hi to so-and-so, and you haven't written me in a while, this kind of annoys me. There's even this ancient piece of hate mail. It's clearly not actual hate mail. It's a joke, but it takes the formula of, like, may you have a good day, and it says, instead says, may you have a bad day, and we'll have a bad time together. And it's written in red as if it's a curse, and it's clear that since someone took the time to write this and address it, that this was an inside joke. And it also shows that the ancient Egyptians had very well developed senses of humor.
You have been, how many times have you actually been to Cairo to maybe excavation or research and work?
I have honestly lost count.
Yeah. Do you still get that little chill up your spine and that thrill when you, like, get off the plane and see everything?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't think that ever goes away.
You, like you said, you have this new book coming out. And we're going to tie you down right now. We're going to say you're coming back out when that book comes out so we can talk more in detail about it. Do you have any new productions, any new documentary productions in the works that you can talk about?
So I do have several coming out, none that I can share the details of, unfortunately, at the moment. But in the meantime, we do have a few videos up on YouTube. Need to make more. That is quite a time commitment, I have to say. And that the channel is also Vintage Egyptologist, and hopefully producing some more content there as well.
And I know you're getting ready to leave in a few days, and you really stress for time now. So we're going to dive deeper, if I could speak, into Egyptology when you come back. But I have to ask about the fashion. Where did your obsession and your love of 1920s fashion and culture come from? Because it's just, it's incredible. I love it.
Well, thank you. I have always had an interest in fashion and really started collecting vintage some years ago. And it was a passion that John and I have very much indulged in with not only, obviously, 1920s, dresses for me, but suits for him. And it's been a lot of fun on the hunt for vintage styles. And what's so wonderful is, I mean, I really like the silhouette. I feel like that it's a good fit for me, 20s and 30s styles. And one of the things I like so much about vintage clothing is that there is a decade for everybody, because there's so many different silhouettes, there's so many different styles and fabrics. And I like the vintage fabric. Vintage style is sustainable. I mean, you're not using any resources, and the quality of the fabric is just phenomenal. So yeah, it's a whole bunch of things all tied together in terms of loving the 1920s. Plus, it's just fundamentally, like, I really like how it looks.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's really, and you really nailed pretty. The hairdo. And the hair and the makeup, I mean, you nail it perfectly. No one gets it just right, and you do. It's just...
Well, it's always gorgeous to see on every documentary you've been on. It's just such a joy to see. It's very engaging as well, because it's like you're back in the 1920s and 30s in the heyday of Egyptology when, you know... Oh, it's just amazing. I love it every time. And it is something that... You know, my mum enjoys as well seeing. I think you're one of her favorite historians.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
Yeah, and I know you got to run. I know you're really stressed for time, so we'll do a real quick bonus round right now with just a couple quick flash questions. There are no wrong answers, like I always say, unless you get one wrong, at which point we'll tell you you're wrong.
Horrible Brian.
I know. Question number one, Pluto, is it a planet or no?
I'll remain agnostic on that one.
The sun is the most important thing in the world, Brian.
It is to me. But question number...
Well, okay, I'll amend the answer.
Okay.
The ancient Egyptians did not have Pluto as a planet.
Technicality. Technicality.
I knew one of those ancient Egyptians.
Yeah. Question number two. Not necessarily the best, not necessarily the most famous, but who is your favorite of the Egyptian kings or queens? Which pharaoh or queen is your personal favorite? Maybe even fascination, or just in the history that you know of?
Because I have spent the last 2 years with John thinking about them almost exclusively, I'm going to go with the obvious, Akhenaten and Nefertiti.
Ah, good answers. Three, will you come back after the book comes out so we can talk more in depth and details about this? And maybe Sarah will be here, because she's really mad at me that I get to talk to you when she's not here.
Sure.
All right. Now, like I said, you got the book coming out. Please plug the book. Give us release dates. If we can pre-order it, where? Best places to see you.
Okay, so you can get signed up with all updates at Instagram. My handle is @vintage_Egyptologist. There's a link in the bio right now that gives you a list of where you can buy Egypt's Golden Couple. So it's available at all major booksellers, including Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But we also have a deal with a local independent bookseller, RJ Julia, that is offering free personalized signed copies. So if you order from RJ Julia, you're not only supporting an independent bookseller, but you can get a personalization and autographed copy by me and John at the cover price. And it will appear, the publication date is November 1st, 2022.
Incredible. And Dr. Donella, again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
And this has been the thrill of a lifetime. And Lauren, anything before we finally let her go? We got her chained up and not letting her leave yet, but
oh, there's so many questions that I have. It would be unfair to start asking them now, because
Next time we're going to have a whole bunch of questions with you.
Okay, that sounds fun.
Thank you so much, and we'll be talking soon.
Thank you. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Brian. This was really fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Lauren, was that not such a fun interview?
That was.
I can't wait till she comes back. There's going to be all kinds of news she can tell us. We're going to talk about her book coming out.
I've got that book on pre-order.
Yeah, and we're going to get to hear all about this trip to Cairo. And I'm just giddy about it, because she really is just an absolutely fascinating, charming, just brilliant woman. Again, like you said earlier, we really appreciate her being able to set aside any time to come and talk to us, because that's just total class. She's a class act all the way.
That's the word I was looking for. She's very classy, classy lady.
Yes, and yet you welcome her on by naming the names Theo wants to give your children. That's very classy, Lauren.
I know, right?
And you know what? As short as this interview was, people aren't going to be disappointed, because next week's show,
we really go out to town.
Well, I know we're going to go long on that one, because we've got the wonderful Kurt Konecki and Neil Story, Kurt of the Strange Sessions and Neil of the Strange Individual, coming back on the show. And when this fearless foursome get together, it's kind of tough to shut us up.
Oh, yeah. I love that Neil goes on some podcast and they have to disclaim. They have to give a disclaimer out.
Do they really?
They do.
Why?
Because if his jokes are a bit, they can be taken the wrong way.
Well, I'm not putting, my disclaimer is listen to Neil's story. He's fucking awesome.
I think your mother would go and beat those people up if they found him.
Oh, my mother loves Neil. And even though Neil was just with us talking about Dracula, he'll be back because we're going into one of his other fields of expertise, the paranormal, with, of course, Kurt, who is ghost hunter, co-host of the Strange Sessions podcast, and just an all-around great guy. I can't wait for that show. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then we've got a few other shows coming right after that are just going to be all kinds of history goodness.
Yes, and I think, I don't know if you remember from around Halloween time, the author AJ West, he's hoping to come back on sometime in June.
Really? Have you spoken to him?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
He's more than welcome anytime. So AJ back on, the world famous AJ West. Hell of a nice guy, too. Oh, he was so much fun. Yeah. So we got a lot of great stuff coming up, even though, you know, my little mini vacation's coming up in a few weeks. So I do want to warn people now, we may, in early June, there might be one week where there's a delay in the episode for a week because, hey, I need a vacation, too. But other than that, what do you say we call this one a show, Lauren?
We should call this one a show, yes.
It's always lovely to talk to you, Lauren, because you are my favorite person in the world when you laugh at my jokes. So, from Brian in Buffalo.
I'm Lauren in Swansea.
Good night.
Good night. Fuck. Shit. Fuck all. And dickhead.